Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
All right, kiddos, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Joined again on the phone by John Pfeffer. He is from Foreign Policy in Focus. And he wrote this very important piece, FPIF.org. It'll be running on antiwar.com over the weekend here. The Middle East's New Nakba. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, John?
Good, good. Thanks for having me on the show.
Very, very happy to have you back on. Really great piece that you did here. I like how you're so good on history that you can make all the proper comparisons and parallels and draw all the right lessons and stuff. It's the difference between data and knowledge going on here. So I like that. The Middle East new Nakba. Well, first of all, what's a Nakba?
Nakba is a catastrophe, and it refers to the displacement of millions of Palestinians and 1948, when Israel was created. And obviously for Israelis, 1948 is a date to be celebrated, creation of Israel. But for Palestinians, it's a tragedy. And many ended up in refugee camps far from their original villages. Many would like to return to the villages that they left more than 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, so you bring up India and Pakistan and the split after the British left, or the split that the British made as they were leaving, I guess, however you want to characterize that, the breakup of the Balkans and, you know, what it means when people are stuck on the so-called wrong side of the ethnic and religious lines and the different kinds of ethnic cleansing. So what's the point of bringing up those examples in context of what's happening in the Middle East now?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's a belief somehow that, you know, if people end up in the right place, in other words, with their religious or ethnic brothers and sisters, then suddenly life will be fine. That the problem lies in the mixture of people and the heterogeneity of countries that causes conflict. And what people often forget in their attempts to create more homogeneous nation states is the tremendous tragedy, not only of the partition itself, and I bring up India, Pakistan, Greece, and Turkey, because of the huge number of people who died during these ethnic cleansing campaigns, but the tragedy of the end of these multicultural societies. Now, of course, there's still Muslims in India, and there's still some Hindus in Pakistan, but previously, these were much richer multicultural countries, and the partitions, in fact, didn't end the conflicts between peoples. In many cases, it just pushed these conflicts up to international rather than internal conflicts. We're facing something very similar in the Middle East today. We're seeing millions and millions of people being expelled from Syria, leaving either voluntarily because of the horrific civil war that's taking place, or actually being expelled by, in many cases, the Islamic State because they're the wrong religion, or they might even be the right religion, but they don't practice it the way the Islamic State would like them to practice it. In other words, the same kind of ethnic cleansing campaign is sweeping through the Middle East, again, toward a goal, ultimately, of creating homogeneous states. But in fact, all this is doing is creating tremendous misery and also pushing these conflicts to a different level.
Yeah. Well, and of course, we've seen really since the invasion in 03, where the parties, I'm not trying to accuse the entire Shiite civilian population of Iraq or anything like that, but the parties with the power, and especially the ones chosen by Bush to accentuate the power of, like the Supreme Islamic Council and the Dawa Party, Skiri's Badr Brigade Army, they were on a policy from really the very beginning after the war of basically conscripting the U.S. Army and Marine Corps in their service to help kick all the Sunnis out of Baghdad. And they kind of been, you know, it's kind of waxed and waned just how hard they were pushing at any given time. And I guess they sort of backed off for a little while. But now it looks like, you know, like in the Sunni neighborhoods in the southwest of Baghdad and other places in, was it Nasiriyah province, is kind of between Baghdad and Kurdistan, but a little bit to the east there, where there were Sunnis, the Shiite militias are now finishing kicking them out and into Islamic State territory. So this is, you know, something that we should never let it go unmentioned, no matter how obvious it should be to people, that George W. Bush kicked this all off with his invasion from Kuwait in 2003.
Absolutely. And you're right, first, in terms of what the Shiite militias are doing in Iraq. They're basically using the Islamic State as an excuse to go after any and all Sunnis that they wanted to kick out of territories and claim those territories for themselves, a process of ethnic cleansing on the ground, mirrored, of course, by what the Islamic State is doing. And number two, you're absolutely correct that, you know, this process, this kind of larger decomposition of multi-ethnic states in the region was kicked off by the invasions of the invasion of Iraq by the Bush administration and the earlier conflict, the first Gulf War against Saddam Hussein. Yeah. The Bush administration, you know, had this conception that it could recreate the Middle East according to the U.S. template, and that would be to create these new states essentially that would be allies to the United States, much as, say, Saudi Arabia or Israel is an ally of the United States. But of course, they didn't really think through this very carefully because they weren't really thinking so much in terms of what would happen to the people on the ground. They were only thinking in terms of very narrow policy goals, i.e. getting rid of Saddam Hussein or securing U.S. access to natural resources. They didn't realize that, of course, what they were doing was going to trigger an enormous kind of Nakba, an enormous catastrophe in the region. Subsequently, of course, the United States aligned itself with one faction or another in order to continue to achieve these narrow goals, mm-hmm. and only further kind of accentuated the kind of decentralization process, further accentuated the ethnic cleansing that took place, and of course, continued, you know, these conflicts that have claimed huge numbers of lives, you know, hundreds of thousands, you know, upwards of half a million in Iraq, or around a third of a million in Syria. And of course, the expulsion of enormous numbers of people. We're talking about, half the population of Syria is currently displaced. About 4 million people have left the country. This is a catastrophe of huge dimensions.
Yeah. Well, and you know, you look back to it, say 2003 and 4, we can't leave now, or the violence will get worse. And so we have to stay in order to prevent the thing. When in fact, all the incentive that the Shia majority could have possibly had to negotiate with the Sunni minority, we were relieving them of those pressures by allowing them to use our Army and Marine Corps to accomplish their goals. And now maybe there would have been a massive civil war, which I guess the Shia would have been bound to win eventually anyway, even if we had left. But if the Shiite parties had ever had any incentive to hold Iraq together and negotiate with the Sunni, it would have been if the Americans had left, not staying there and basically acting as, you know, Sadr and al-Hakim's special forces brigades.
Yeah. I mean, in Korea, you know, the divided Korean peninsula, people would often tell me that U.S. military presence was like a knife stuck into the peninsula. And that they were worried that if they took the knife out, the peninsula would bleed to death. And so that was a justification for the continued presence of the U.S. military in the Korean Peninsula. But what they didn't realize, of course, that the knife was not just in place, that the knife was actually twisting as well. And this clearly the case in the Middle East as well. The presence of the U.S. military was no longer simply holding internal organs in place and preventing a bleed out. It was actually continuing to do damage.
Yeah. And all right, wait, stop right there, John. We got to stop. It's John Pfeffer, everybody, from FPIF, Foreign Policy and Focus, FPIF.org. We'll be right back. Hey, all, Scott here.
On average, how much do you think these interviews are worth to you? Of course, I've never charged for my archives in a dozen years of doing this, and I'm not about to start. But at patreon.com/ScottWhartonShow, you can name your own price to help support and make sure there's still new interviews to give away. So what do you think? 2 bits? A buck and a half? There are usually about 80 interviews per month, I guess, so take that into account. You can also cap the amount you'd be willing to spend in case things get out of hand around here. That's patreon.com/ScottWhartonShow. And thanks, y'all. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for MPV Engineering. This isn't for all of you, but for high-end contractors specializing in industrial construction and end users who own and operate industrial equipment, MPV offers licensed professional consulting on chemical and mechanical engineering for your projects. Tanks, pressure vessels, piping, heat exchangers, HVAC equipment, chemical reactors for oil companies or manufacturing facilities, as well as project management support and troubleshooting for those implementing designs. MPV will get your industrial project up and running. Head over to mpvengineering.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org for all the stuff. Follow me on Twitter, at Scott Horton Show, although I warn you, I might be mean to you. I'm kind of mean on there. I'm talking with John Pfeffer from Foreign Policy in Focus, FPIF.org, and antiwar.com, or original.antiwar.com/Pfeffer. This one will be running over the weekend, the Middle East's new Nakba. The complete upturning of the Middle East and the creation of this massive sectarian war, if you want to call it that, a regional war between the Saudis and the Iranians, with America on our enemy's side as the Saudis use Al-Qaeda shock troops to get their dirty work done in Iraq and Syria, and America is trying to stand in the way of all those who would fight our enemies for us and help our enemies win instead. And this has helped. Well, you know, they're redirecting from back when they accidentally took Iran's side in Iraq War II, which they didn't mean to do. So now they're trying to fix that by making everything 10 times worse. And, you know, honestly, John, when I heard the recent refugee numbers, I didn't believe them because I was going, wait a minute, wait. How can it possibly add up? They're saying, I'm sorry, worldwide, I think they were saying 60 million or something like that, or 50 million people or something. And I went adding it up and got some help from Dan Sanchez. And then, yeah, no, that really panned out. And about what, somewhere approximately 10 million of these are from America's wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and Libya, maybe more than that.
That's correct. It's just a little under 60 million. And this is the largest since World War II. It's unbelievable, frankly, the numbers. Afghanistan was the leading kind of source of refugees up until Syria overtook it. And the last year or two, Syrian war has really pushed millions of people out of the country. And, you know, it only registered on the radar of the world community when these folks started showing up in Europe. Because, of course, you know, there were almost 2 million Syrians in Turkey. There are a million or so in Lebanon and Jordan, in refugee camps that in those latter two countries that no longer have sufficient funds to cover their food and basic health services. It's a unbelievable slow motion tragedy taking place in those refugee camps because the international community has not put sufficient funds toward that. But it only became an issue when these folks decided that it was impossible to live in Jordan and Lebanon and continued to on in an attempt to get into Europe, either by boat across the Mediterranean or the land route through Turkey up through the Balkans. And now, of course, we're looking at more than 1 million people flooding into Europe. And suddenly this has become an issue. And, you know, it's only when people show up at the door of the rich countries that the rich countries really take notice.
Yeah. Well, and even then they don't. They just keep on bombing Yemen and keep on bombing Iraq. And even when the Russians finally call their bluff, they want to keep on supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria. And they must be crazy.
Yeah. It's, I mean, I think the Europeans, well, some of the Europeans have taken a step back to examine the kind of effect of these aerial attacks in Syria and Iraq. on the not only the flow of refugees, but on the kind of centrifugal violence that is spinning these countries apart, namely Iraq and Syria. The United States, well, the United States hasn't really taken a step back. I mean, of course, at the UN, President Obama did say, and this is good, that, you know, diplomacy is really the only answer here, that military solution is not the solution. But that doesn't really register so much in terms of U.S. policy. We continue to conduct an enormous number of aerial sorties, up around 7,000. And, you know, Russia, too, has said that there should be a political solution, but that hasn't prevented Russia from entering the fray as well. They conducted their first aerial attacks this last week. So, unfortunately, you know, the principal countries, United States, Russia, and the European Union, have not sat down to push for a political solution. I think Iran has consistently pushed for a political solution, but it's been frozen out of these discussions for the most part. So it's finally, I think, time for all of these concerned countries to say, hey, look, it's obvious what the effects are of this strategy. They've failed these aerial attacks. We have to obviously push for a political solution.
Okay, now this is crazy, but I'm going to ask you what you think about it. And I'm sure you'll say, no, that's crazy. But Eric Margolies says that he's a damn liar and he's just trying to take extra credit for himself, and it's not true. But and Eric Margolies might well know that for a fact. Zbigniew Brzezinski claims that he had Jimmy Carter start backing the Mujahideen in Afghanistan before the Russians invaded in order to provoke them into invading, that it was his brilliant idea all along, not just he took advantage of their invasion, but that he helped to provoke it to give them their own Vietnam, which, of course, you and I probably have laughed over the years about. Here's America giving ourselves our own Vietnam in Afghanistan again, with all the harm that comes from doing that to yourself, that kind of thing. But so it's not that difficult to discern. And for all the talk about how smart our brilliant commander-in-chief is with his third-dimensional chess and this, that, and the other thing, somewhat devotee of Zbigniew Brzezinski, is it possible that Obama's half-assed, failed, as you called it, campaign of backing the Mujahideen against Assad for the last 4 years has actually been the exact same program again, trying to lure the Russians into invading and bogging themselves down against the Mujahideen, just like in the 1980s, and that it's all, this is Putin basically falling for the same scam again?
Well, it's an interesting idea, but no. I mean, I think the one of the primary goals of the Obama administration has been to contain Russia and to push it as far out of the Middle East as possible, to deny it its one base in Syria, TARDIS, to essentially freeze it out of any kind of geopolitical role. It would prefer it not to be involved even in the near abroad. In other words, the former members of the Soviet Union, the republics, but it obviously has been unable to do that. I do, however, think, and this is an argument I made, you know, back in 2002, that Osama bin Laden had very much this strategy on his mind, very much the Zbigniew Brzezinski strategy,
right,
of luring the United States into conflicts in the Middle East and Afghanistan, that it was only when the United States would be battling far from its strength and battling against non-state actors for the most part, that it would potentially face the same kind of crisis that the Soviet Union faced in Afghanistan. And of course, Osama bin Laden knew very well what happened to the Soviet Union in Afghanistan, and so he didn't have a lot of models from which to choose. And I do think that motivated him, and that was the kind of strategy lurking behind his attacks on U.S. targets.
Oh, yeah, no question about it. He said it from 1996 on, exactly what he was up to. No question there. But so, I mean, it seems like Brzezinski's still around, and they must have learned the lesson that actually the failure of containment after Vietnam, when the American people didn't want to contain the Soviet Union anymore, and it expanded its commitments into Latin America, Africa, and Afghanistan especially, that that's what finally broke the Soviet Union. So I totally would... I'm just pretending that Brzezinski's smart for just a second and that he's talking with Obama and that he's trying to even think in terms of a couple of moves ahead on the chessboard here. And hell yeah, they want to keep him out of Ukraine. They want Ukraine in NATO if they can because they're that loony. But maybe if we could squeeze him here and squeeze him here, but push him into a no-win quagmire, Osama bin Laden, Zbigniew Brzezinski's style plot to bog them down fighting the Mujahideen in Syria, that would be a perfect way to finally, you know, bankrupt the Kremlin government and get their regime change in Russia, which is what they're really all about here, right?
Well, you know, if you wanted to be Brzezinski about all this, and I would have to say that Brzezinski, for all of the craziness that he promoted during the 1970s and 1980s, in comparison to the neocons, he's proven, you know, quite a realist, you know, and therefore.
Well, he's been good on Iran. I mean, exactly. That's for sure. There's definitely a line between his view and theirs on Iran, but on who controls the world island and all of that, I think.
Yeah, well,
he's pretty much in the lead.
Right. From that point of view, I mean, really, the key here, if you wanted to pin down Russia, it would not so much be to bring them into Syria, but to really accelerate and encourage the centrifugal trends within Russia itself. I mean, we're looking at North Caucasus, Dagestan, areas that Russia has had great difficulty controlling. And, you know, if you wanted to be Zbigniew about this, you know, you wouldn't really push so much for the Syria scenario. You would look for encouraging the Islamic State affiliates in that area, as well as the Chechens, to basically push against federal control in Moscow. Mm-hmm. I mean, that hits much harder at Putin and at the Russian kind of project than anything that would take place in Syria.
Yeah. Although, I mean, they're just getting started, right? So, and they're in a real tough spot. I mean, even if America and the allies backed off supporting the Mujahideen now, which I don't think is really likely, they're probably more likely to double down, the Saudis and Turks, especially for supporting these guys. It doesn't seem, you know, I'm sure the Russian Petraeus is asking, tell me how this ends now that they're there and have this task of supporting, you know, Hezbollah and what's left of the Syrian army against these. I mean, they are just Al-Qaeda loonies with suicide bombers and AKs, but there are apparently legions of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, they're still around a fighting strength of 20 to 30,000. But, you know, I do think that Putin is really looking to elevate his kind of geopolitical stature in this. And, you know, no one's going to take him seriously if he's just going to be saying, look, we're friends of Bashar al-Assad. People will take him seriously when they're actually launching airstrikes. And I think that ultimately is what Putin wants. He wants a place at the table. He wants to be able to help determine whatever outcome is around the corner in Syria. I don't see him really committing more troops. And there's only a small contingent of Russians there. There's very little popularity inside Russia for the presence of Russian troops in Syria. I think Putin is very, very smart about the fragility not only of Russian position in Syria, but even to a certain extent, the fragility of his own political support within Russia. I don't think he wants to do anything that could jeopardize that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess there actually has been in the last week, and I'm sorry I'm keeping you over time here. Let me just ask you this one more thing here. Kerry and Obama and a couple of others have started using language like, yeah, well, maybe Assad could go at the end of the negotiations instead of the beginning and that kind of thing. Are those little trial balloons, is that just propaganda, or that's actually a signal that they've realized they have to back down from this policy, that they cannot debothify this government and abolish this army without turning Damascus over to Al-Qaeda, at best ISIS, you know, supposedly even worse than that?
Oh, absolutely. I think there is a dose of realism within the State Department and within the Pentagon as well about the inability of the United States to determine the outcome on the ground militarily. They dug themselves into a difficult position by insisting that Assad had to leave, and they're kind of walking their way back from that position. The real question is not so much, what kind of political solution. Because it's too premature to talk about that. But really, the question is, who will sit down at the table to talk about it? And that, I think, they're still kind of working out. And, I think Iran has to play a major role here. And that's something that hitherto the Obama administration has been very uncomfortable with. And it knows that it's going to get serious congressional pushback from such a proposal. But ultimately, Iran has to be at the table, and that is really the bigger question than the disposition of Assad when he goes, if he goes, etc.
Right. Okay. Well, listen, man, I really appreciate you coming back on the show, John.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
All right, y'all. That is the great John Pfeffer. He's at Foreign Policy in Focus, FPIF.org, and you can also find him at original.antiwar.com/Pfeffer. And over this weekend, we'll be running the Middle East's new Nakba. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, y'all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.